Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bratbold, Judge Ross, and Judge Smith. The Honorable Diane B. Bratbold presiding.
Good morning. Let's all be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today's date is March 27th, 2025. Again, welcome to our court, and I assume that you're familiar with the procedures in our court, but if you have any questions, please let us know. We always look forward to this day and having a chance to hear from the lawyers in the case. I see a couple of things. First of all, this matter is being circulated via Zoom, so video conference and made available to the public. We also maintain a recording, an audio recording of today's proceedings. So that informs my suggestion to you that when you approach the podium to not only get yourself situated and comfortable and have your glass of water or materials nearby, but to make sure that before you start your argument that you identify yourself as well as the client you represent, and that's to keep our record very clear. I would like to ask the marshal to call the first case, and then I will make a few additional remarks. So go right ahead, Marshal.
Calling A23-1793, State of Minnesota Respondent versus Jess Steven Johnson, Appellant.
And the last thing I would say is just to ask you to please keep an eye on the clock. You are familiar, I think, with our timelines.
They tend to go quickly, and we very much enjoy this
opportunity. So, Counsel for Appellant, you can go ahead when you're ready.
Please the court, counsel. My name is Charles Clippard. I'm appearing on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Jess Johnson. The facts underlying Mr. Johnson's conviction are pretty simple. He was at the home of a protected party when the police were called. He was there. He was on body camera there in violation of a domestic abuse no contact order. And the real issue at trial was whether, the factual issue at trial is whether Mr. Johnson knowingly violated the provisions of that no contact order. The issues that bring us here are, would suggest, a bit thornier. At a pretrial hearing on July 14th of 2023, there was a hearing on motions in limine. And toward the end of that hearing, the prosecutor noted that there were some Rule 20 concerns from the jail. And I think that's really important that it's not like a behavioral issue or a, it's a very specific concern. It's a Rule 20 concern. And then the judge noted that he, too, had been aware of some disturbances or and that Mr. Johnson was in segregation or lockdown. The court conferred with Mr. Johnson's advisory counsel, and the lawyer conceded he didn't think there was anything, but he had limited contact with Mr. Johnson, and no Rule 20 was ordered. And the crux of the argument is that that was enough. That was enough to have triggered the concern to raise a Rule 20. I spent some time talking about the subsequent Rule 20 where he was found incompetent, and I think that's important because it shows that there was a significant long-term documented mental health issue with Mr. Johnson. I don't think we can use the Rule 20 from later to say, oh yeah, that was evidence of his incompetence at this time. But I think that's an important issue because it shows that the idea of him being incompetent is not to some far-fetched
concern. Ask, counsel, what's the standard of review for evaluating the district court's determination to order or not order at that time?
Actually, you are not bound by the same deference as you would normally in a fact-finding case. I just actually have the standard right here.
I'm sure you gave it to us, but...
In reviewing competency issue, this court does not grant the district court the usual fact-finding deference before turning to a consideration of the circumstances on the incident case. It's necessary to say a few words about the scope of our review. What is involved here is alleged denial of a constitutional rights of due process and fair trial. While the issue is cast in the form of a factual determination, we are not permitted to accord it the usual deference given to a trial court's findings. That's on my brief at page 12, and that's State v. Bauer.
So what does that mean, de novo? I ask because, you know, there's the comment from the jail that's reported by I'm sorry, who reported his lawyer?
No, the prosecutor.
Prosecutor, that's right, thank you. And then, but the judge had also seen the defendant and had the judge's own experience, the district court's own experience of the defendant. So what, and if that seemed contrary or didn't, you know, match that, like what do we, is there just one thing must have been error by the district court then not to order the Rule 20 when there could also be other information that would be knowable to the district? That's what I'm trying to figure out here.
Sure. And the court did rely, and the respondent did rely significantly on and Mr. Johnson's in-court behavior. I think that's, you know, it's obviously part of the picture. You can't say you ignore it because it's part of the equation. But I think in this case it was given overly credited by the district court. Because if you think about it, the jail's with Mr. Johnson, whatever, the 23 hours that he's not in court or whatever else. He's there day to day. They're seeing him all the time. I started my career as a district court public defender in Ramsey County. And you can go into a holding cell and talk to a client and it can be fur flying and it can be people are angry. Then he comes out in the courtroom and you're like, you know, who is this person? You know, they were just calling me all sorts of names and all of a sudden they're in front of the judge in the formality of the courtroom and they shape up. So
what does the record tell us about the extent and nature of the court, the judge's involvement with the defendant?
And I think that's the problem. Well, at least on July 14th, that's the problem. There's no interaction with Mr. Johnson. And I think if you look
Counsel, let me just stop you for a second there. We're talking about the motion in limine hearing?
Yes.
Before which is a Friday, I think, before the trial was scheduled to start?
Right.
Is that right?
Right.
When you say no involvement with Mr. Johnson, I mean, the district court did a full hearing on, what, 13 motions in limine?
Right.
Right. So I mean, at least on that day, the district court had a fairly, I mean, you tell me what you think, but it seemed to me like it was at least a significant amount of time with Mr. Johnson and could see how he conducted himself with regard to those motions in limine.
Right. And I certainly understand the court's point, but if you look at Bonga, the court actually had engaged the defendant in that case to determine his competency. So rather than just saying, you know, standby counsel, what do you think? Mm-hmm. The district court didn't engage Mr. Johnson saying, Mr. Johnson, I got some concerns from the jail. Where's your brain right now? Where's your mental health? Are you understanding what's going on here?
My question went more just to the general interaction that Judge Bratville is referring mm-hmm. to. The record does suggest back and forth and allow an opportunity, maybe not in the specific context of competence, but I'm assuming the folks in the jail also didn't have that conversation about competence, and they're able to glean something of a concern. So why wouldn't the judge also be able to at least have some impression about competence outside a discussion of competence specifically?
Yeah, and I guess this kind of goes back to a point raised by the government or the respondent. You know, competence is a moment in time. And so maybe he was competent at a pretrial hearing on the 12th, and maybe his competency was deteriorating, but it hadn't gotten to the point where it was. And I guess that's the problem I have is I'm almost in a catch-22 because I'm trying to argue my client was incompetent. I tried to get an evaluation, but the argument is against me, so that there's no evidence he was incompetent, so I don't get the evaluation. It's I'm chasing my tail a little bit, but I think on this record there was, though, and I think the warning from the jail is sufficient to put the court on notice to at least do the evaluation. And what makes this case maybe a little trickier than most that come up here on Rule 20s is that he's representing himself. My experience, even if I thought there would be an issue with my client trusting me, I would say, I'd approach the bench and say, Your Honor, I think my client is Rule 20. Could you order it? And then the judge orders it and it kind of protects my relationship with my client. So given that he's representing himself, I think that almost puts a heightened obligation on the court and the prosecutor to make sure that this individual is competent. It's not in the rules, but I think it's kind of common sense.
I was going to say, we don't have that in our case law, right?
Right.
Yeah. Let me ask you, this is a slight variation on the question that Judge Smith asked about our standard of review. You referred to the Bauer case, and for good reason. I don't criticize that. But I just want to ask you about the Manga case, which talked about that we would review the record to determine whether the district court gave proper weight to the information suggesting incompetence. I think that's also in your brief, as I recall. When it came to the conclusion, there was not sufficient doubt of the defendant's competency so as to require further inquiry. So what standard of review does that suggest to you? I mean, would you characterize it as a de novo review of the proper weight of the evidence, and how does that fit into our facts?
Yeah, I think you're on a de novo review. I think the record's poorly developed of the facts that were going on in the jail that raised the Rule 20 concern. And I think that record is woefully inadequate, but I think given that it seems to be uncontradicted that there were Rule 20 concerns in the jail, that you have that, and you have to apply de novo whether that is sufficient to put the court on notice to order the Rule 20 evaluation.
Okay. And I guess the second last thing I'll ask you or call to your attention is, as best I could determine and my staff could determine, well, the central staff looked at it as well, the Rule 20 evaluation that was eventually done of Mr. Johnson, and I hear your argument to say I'm not arguing that that proves he was incompetent at the time of the trial. But, you know, it's referenced by the district court in post-conviction proceedings. It's referenced by counsel in their briefs. It is not in our record.
I think I attached it to my post-conviction petition.
Well, I can't say I've looked at absolutely everything, but that's what my staff, and I've looked at a lot. I didn't see it. My staff, the same. So if that is true, I mean, we'll look, check again in light of what you just said, see if it was attached, and perhaps we missed it. Is this something that you feel should be corrected in the record? And I will ask the same question of the state's attorney.
If it wasn't attached, my intention was to make it part of the record at the post-conviction.
And that was our sense. As I said, the district court referred to it in the post-conviction order, so it seems to us it was clearly in front of the court, and it should be included in the record. I'm speaking broadly and not for my colleagues, but just wanted to get your take on it. Thank you.
Sure.
You may want to move on to the waiver issue just in light of your time, but, of course, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. It's up to you.
Sure. In the waiver issue, obviously there was no formal waiver that complied with the rule, so we're back into the facts and the circumstances of Mr. Johnson's situation. And, Mr. Magnuson does a very nice job of noticing, the contacts my client had and his interactions with his attorney at the time before he was discharged. But again, he discharges his lawyer because she's not working for him. I think that should have, again, at least put him on notice that maybe there's something more going on, and whether that was a knowing and intelligent waiver of his right to an attorney.
I know you're familiar with the case law in this area. I mean, there is substantial case law that indicates that where discharges their counsel voluntarily, it's more or less assumed, right, or presumed, mm-hmm. that at that point in time, the defendant was aware of the benefits and disadvantages of either being represented or self-represented.
Right.
So doesn't that essentially eliminate your argument on?
I don't think that's a per se rule. I think it's one of the many factors that you would have to consider. And again, he was represented by a lawyer before he discharged them. I think that.
And you agree that he voluntarily discharged, right?
Appears so, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
I think his mother makes a big part of the record on this case, and there may have been some interference there, but I can't do anything about that. But that I think is kind of the fact of what was going on. Mm-hmm. But I think the case law, again, I think it's Draley, maybe I'm mispronouncing that right now, but talks about if someone's represented before they discharge that lawyer, that is, again, a factor that the person may have been advised of their rights. Mm-hmm. And again, I'll have to concede that he acknowledged his rights in an arraignment. His lawyer acknowledged his rights. But whether those rights are front of mind when he discharges his lawyer at a later time is, I guess, another question. And that's why one of my frustrations is, why don't we follow the rule? Mm-hmm. the rule's clear. This is what we need to do, rather than running to an exception. So... I have no additional comments on the waiver, though. So if the court has no other questions, my remedy here, I guess, is still to move to have a Rule 20. And I think the court's decision saying it has no authority to do that, it actually is a de novo review, and I think the court can. And I think that
you're talking about having a retroactive Rule 20,
yes.
Right? Which, again, you're familiar with the arguments that have been made. I mean, I don't see any legal authority for that. So I appreciate your argument is that the rule says at any time, but you've read the arguments of the state, and it seems that the entire rule structure around a Rule 20 has to do with a defendant's present state of mind, mm-hmm. And their current competence. It is not to order have a court intervene and order, hey, were they incompetent in the past? You know, this is now well post-conviction.
But I guess this is my kind of the point I have with Judge Ross. I mean, is Mr. Johnson just out of luck?
Okay.
We screwed up? You know, you were tried when you're incompetent and there's no remedy? The record I have right now, I can't make an incompetent argument because it just isn't developed.
So how would the finding in a future Rule 20 competency hearing establish competence at the time that you believe he should have been subject to a Rule 20 hearing?
And Your Honor, I want a chance. I don't know what I'm going to get. And I think as time passes, it makes my argument a whole lot harder.
No, but let's assume that the result turned out the way you might expect it to, that he's now incompetent. How does that bear upon competency? I mean, what are we determining in a future decision? What exactly would be the effect of a finding of incompetence at the time of a post-appeal Rule 20?
My request was to do a kind of a retroactive Rule 20 to see whether he was competent at the time of his trial.
Do you need that to get relief? If he should have gotten a Rule 20, we would hold that he should have gotten, the district court should have ordered a Rule 20, isn't reversal required of the convictions?
Yeah.
Irrespective of whether he has another Rule 20?
Right, and I guess the court, I guess my petition was asking in the district court was to, for a retroactive Rule 20, but I think you're right. If the court says he should have gotten the Rule 20, we reverse, that would be
inappropriate. Is that the outcome in cases where appellate courts have held that there should have been a Rule 20?
Yes.
Okay. Just to be clear, you're not aware of any case that provides the remedy that you were suggesting?
My request in the district court was very novel. I've never seen that before. Thank you, Your Honor.
Someone's got to make new law.
Right, exactly.
No, thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent, we're ready when you are.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning. My name is Peter Magnuson. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent the respondent state of Minnesota. I just want to address counsel's opening comment that the comment relayed from jail staff was sufficient to trigger a Rule 20.01 examination. Just sitting here thinking about that, I think that's a worrisome standard for a court to adopt. I think if you read the transcripts here, the prosecutor mentioned the jail staff's concerns out of an abundance of caution. If this court rules that any time the phrase Rule 20.01 comes up, that triggers a Rule 20.01 examination, my worry is that people will be less reluctant to use that phrase, knowing that there's case law out there saying that automatically triggers an examination.
Would we have to be saying it automatically, though? I mean, here you have an unrepresented party before you. The prosecutor raises, and we don't know, I don't know if he said or she said this is an abundance of caution or just raised it, you know? Or just thought, okay, this is what I heard, Rule 20 reports from the jail. In a circumstance where the person is not represented, doesn't have his own lawyer to provide the court information? I mean, I don't know that it's like automatically this comment, full stop, does it, that we would even need to say that. We're saying one would look at the full circumstances and say either de novo or, I don't know exactly, again, we're struggling with the standard of review, that the district court should have ordered it in these circumstances.
Well, I'm just responding to counsel's statement. He's asking you that a comment relayed from jail staff was sufficient to trigger a Rule 20.01. In these circumstances, I don't think there's any question that there wasn't enough information. I lay out the transcripts, but just briefly, you know, at his arraignment on May 9th, he was sentenced on two pending criminal cases. I think the judge could presume that he had no one had raised competency concerns there, and he was sentenced on those cases at his arraignment.
Like a month and a half before? Are we at a July hearing?
No, that's May 9th. That's his very first arraignment. He's sentenced on two pending criminal cases, and those sail through, and then he's arraigned on this, and the defense attorney from that case, who's not yet been appointed, but he tells the court, I've gone through the complaint, I've gone through his rights, you know, all of that stuff, and we'll set it on for an omnibus hearing.
Just so I know the dates, and I should know these, I'm sorry, but what is the date of the report about the Rule 20?
That's June.
Is that not July? Am I mistaken? Maybe not. I see that the motions in limine I see is taking place on July 14th.
June 12th,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, June 12th, yeah. Yes. But May 9th, his first arraignment, there's no competency concerns. May 17th and May 20th, he now has his public defender, and they discuss a relatively difficult concept, the fact that this public defender may have a conflict from a prior case. After talking it over with her client, she advises the court that the defendant is comfortable going forward. So that shows that he's thinking clearly. And that May 19th hearing then, the defendant specifically asked the court to modify the conditions of release because he's got a bed in Brainerd. So he's working with probation staff on his two cases that he was sentenced on. So every step along the way, that he's acting appropriately. And Bonga, I think, is just, I don't know how we can get past Bonga. In Bonga, the issue there was that the defendant had attempted suicide, and then he appears in court and tells his attorney, and the attorney tells his standby counsel, and standby counsel tells the judge that he wants to go forward. And the court does go forward, and the Supreme Court says that's fine. Yes, there was this suicide attempt, but the district court made observations, and very clear observations, about his interactions with the defendant and how he did not believe there were any Rule 20 concerns, and that was enough. Here we don't have any suicide attempt. We have the district court puts on the record that he had heard that he was in lockdown. That indicates to me behavioral concerns. He's not on a suicide watch. He's in lockdown. So there's...
the court said, yeah, I understand he's on lockdown, but the attorney had said that there are Rule 20 concerns at the jail.
Yes.
And the judge, it seems like, maybe just jump to the conclusion. Without asking, okay, what beyond lockdown, what were the circumstances? The court just references lockdown, which may not necessarily ferret out what those concerns were. Should that be a problem for us? Why not? No,
well, again, that comparing that to the suicide attempt in Bonga, they're not even in the same ballpark. So if the suicide attempt in Bonga...
How do we know whether they're in the same ballpark if we don't know what it was that were the concerns of the... I mean, you know, in one case, it was a suicide attempt. That was the concern. In this case, we have an attorney saying, look, there's been some concerns raised, and then... You know, I'm not in the best position to make a motion on his behalf, and the reason is, quote, given that we're set for trial. Why is that not at least a basis to explore further to see what it is that triggered the concerns at the jail.
Again, the judge has been has dealt with this appellant or the defendant at that time since May 9th. I believe he'd also handled part of the previous cases that were sentenced on May 9th. So he's had extensive dealings with this defendant. This defendant, again, was represented by counsel in those prior cases. He's been represented by a public defender in this case who has had multiple discussions with him, has appeared in court with him multiple times. Well, none of those people raised any concerns.
Well, just to be clear, when the judge asked standby counsel didn't say, no, my client's competent, or I believe he's competent. The response was, no, but my contact has been limited. There's a, like, a caveat there. Again, why not? I'm trying to get a sense of what, since there's no one there to advocate who knows what happened, and there's something that happened in the jail, and the court only references the consequence, which is lockdown, but doesn't indicate knowledge of whatever those jail concerns might have been. Why shouldn't that be a concern that we have, at least for the triggering of a competency evaluation?
We have to go by what the judge knew at the time and what the judge reasonably should have done. Again, this judge has seen absolutely nothing that would call the defendant's competency into question. He has shown very high-level reasoning when he rejects the plea offer from the state. I don't want to take another felony. He discharges his attorney because his attorney, you know, like Worthy, he discharges his attorney because...
So, counsel, if you don't mind.
Pardon me?
If you don't mind. So you're now referring back in time to several proceedings before the one we were talking about, which is on July 14th, the Friday before the trial is about to start Monday.
Yes.
Right? Now you're going back in time with the district court's experience. All relevant. Don't get me wrong.
Yes.
All relevant. But we also know, and in fact the rules are written this way, that a defendant can lose competency during the course of proceedings. I mean, this is a situation where Rule 20 concerns have been raised to the district court. The district court's response is really pretty straightforward. I mean, remarks that the district court is aware of disruptions at the jail, that is aware that Mr. Johnson's in lockdown, but then says, there has been nothing in addition brought to my concern or to my attention about any possible Rule 20 concerns that might be there. Now, that I think is saying that no one other than this prosecuting attorney has told the district court about Rule 20 concerns. Those are all fine statements, but back to Judge Ross's question. But everything else, all of these circumstances on this date, don't they suggest further inquiry should have been made by the district court? And again, Bonga talks about proper weight. Did the district court assess the circumstances, giving it proper weight to decide whether to order a Rule 20?
Again, in Bonga, the judge knew that the night before, the defendant had attempted suicide. And the district court didn't order a Rule 20. The district court proceeded. And the district court later... Was there a post-conviction in that? I don't remember off the top of my head. But anyway, on appeal, the Supreme Court talks about all the findings that the district court had made, that all these conversations with counsel, the repeated court hearings with the defendant in front of him, and the conversations on the record, that based on the district court's direct observations, and I think the word is gauge, the Supreme Court says the district court could gauge whether that defendant merited a Rule 20 examination. That's all I'm saying here. Judge Hermerding has had extensive contact with this defendant from May all the way through the end of trial. At no point did this defendant ever give an indication to Judge Hermerding that there was a problem. In fact, he gave exactly the opposite indication. He gave him the indication that, yes, I'm taking my meds. I think I comment in my brief at least two, if not three times, he says, yes, I'm sober, I'm thinking clearly, I'm on my medications. So certainly, yes. In January, when 2024, in February, he's presumably off his medications. He's no longer thinking clearly. And then in November 2024, he regains competence.
Do you know, counsel, when the, I believe the concerns of Rule 20 were raised on July 14. When was the last time the district court saw the appellant? Was it on June 12th?
The last time?
Prior to July 14th, when the Rule 20...
June 12th, June 11th, or July 11th, and, yeah, July 14th.
So prior to July 14th.
Prior
so
to July 14th.
July 11th?
There was May 9th, May 17th, May 19th, May 30th, June 12th, and July 11th.
So July 11th, June 12th, July 11th. Okay,
yep.
Thank you.
And then at trial, and during trial,
because your time is quickly going, I just want to make sure I ask you the question I asked the appellant's lawyer about the, I think it's March 24 competency evaluation, which is referred to by the district court in post-conviction proceedings, but not in our record, I believe. We'll double check. If it's not in the record, is it your understanding it should be in the record? What's your position, if you have one, on that?
I'm not really concerned about what is in the substance of the Rule 20.
Yeah, and your brief is very clear that's irrelevant to the proceedings, but again, it's certainly part of what the district court looked at in post-conviction proceedings. So I just, that's what we normally see in the record, right, is whatever the district court reviewed in making its post-conviction determination.
Yes, because the rule, so he's on probation in this case. He violates it. Those new charges come up. And then there's Rule 20 concerns raised in that new case. So the Rule 20 examination finds him incompetent. I believe Judge Hermerding was handling that case. He's also presiding over this case. So it just kind of was brought over into this case.
But discussed in this case. So you don't dispute that it should be part of the record?
No, I don't have any problem with it being part of the record, no. I don't dispute that he was found incompetent by that Rule 20.
Talk, counsel, about the argument appellant makes about invalid waiver of right to counsel.
Oh, yes. Yes, the post-conviction court, who was also the trial court, notes that he didn't follow the rule and did not get a waiver. Nonetheless, there are several facts, as I point out in my brief. He signed a statement of rights. He was advised by counsel.
Now, that statement of rights is not the same as a Rule 504 advisory, right? I mean, we're all clear on that.
Yep.
Okay.
But he was advised by counsel of the charges and his rights at the arraignment. He was advised at the May 30 hearing. His counsel informed the court that the defendant had been advised of his rights and his charges. Counsel sends an email a week before hearing saying that he wants to discharge me. As we've discussed, there's a presumption that they have discussed the benefits of it. Then when he tells the court he wants to fire his attorney, the district court goes to bat for the defense counsel, says Ms. Hills is a fine attorney, you should hang on to her. So he's aware of the benefits, and he's been advised of it. He had counsel at every step of the way. Standby counsel was immediately appointed.
I guess what troubles me about the transcript, counsel, just to be really direct in light of your time, is that at that hearing, so we're now talking, I think, about the June 12th hearing, when the defendant discharges the public defender's office, or the district court does it after talking to the defendant, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Johnson's intent was very clear. It wasn't to represent himself. He says he wants a new attorney. He's explained to him, well, you won't be getting a new public defender. That's all in the record. But it's not as though the district court then went ahead and discussed, and if you don't hire an attorney, you will have waived your right to counsel, or if there was a July 11th hearing, apparently, in which the district court also spoke with Mr. Johnson. There was no follow-up at that point. There's nothing on the record about Mr. Johnson and the right for representation or the right to waive that representation and represent himself. So what are the circumstances that show that? And I know you briefed it, you give me all the factors, but I'm struggling with the part where we connect the dots between what the district court the district court's engagement with the defendant and then the conclusion that Mr. Johnson, in fact, voluntarily waived his right to counsel.
I think there is a disconnect in the record because he doesn't immediately appoint standby counsel. And I can't remember what the date of the standby counsel is. But the judge does appoint standby counsel. And from that point on, I don't recall there's any discussion in the
record.
July
5th.
Where the defendant tells the court that he wants another attorney. In fact, he just, I think, says that he would like to talk directly with the prosecutor to see if there's a way, as he referred it, I don't want to take another felony. I'd like to see if there's a way this could be a probation
violation.
It's
quite clear he wants to hire a new attorney. So that's where I'm struggling to see that position by Mr. Johnson. I'm just struggling to find the waiver. And, of course, you can go ahead and answer even though the red light is on.
Thank you. Again, the totality of the circumstances here show that there was a waiver. He never pursued hiring another attorney, and as far as the record shows. He never pursued it. The district court appointed standby counsel. So the issue is, did he appear without counsel? And he never did.
Oh, so we don't have to look into whether it was knowing and intelligent because there was standby counsel?
That's just one of the factors from Credgy, Worthy. That's just one of the factors that you look at where there was not an explicit signed waiver and the rule wasn't followed. Then are they entitled to relief? And that's one of the factors that argue against it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, counsel. And you've got 5 minutes for rebuttal, Mr. Clippard. Thank you.
I hope not to use it, all five. But I don't think my concern about counsel's trying to distinguish Bonga and the suicide attempt, I don't think my law degree lets me know the difference between someone being suicidal and someone being incompetent. I don't think that's something. I don't have the training for that. That's why you'd want to bring in a psychologist to know whether that person actually is incompetent. And again, the report from the jail, I mean, he's got rule 20.
Wouldn't Bonga undermine that premise, though, that you're making, the result?
I don't know whether someone who's suicidal can be competent or incompetent. The judge in Bonga found this person, even though he was suicidal, was competent. I don't know if that's always or... I don't think that's a broad, but again, I don't know. and the report from the jail is so vague. I mean, is he hallucinating in his cell, and that's why we have Rule 20 concerns? Because that was one of the concerns in the Rule 20 from 2024 is that he had auditory and visual hallucinations. Is that what's going on? Is that would certainly raise a concern that he would be Rule 20? Because if he doesn't know where he is, then he can't assist in his defense. So I think the comparison to Bonga here is not quite appropriate. So with that, Your Honor, we would ask that the case be, conviction be reversed and the case remanded.
Any other questions? No. Thank you, counsel. Thanks to both lawyers very much. We appreciated the arguments today. The matter was well briefed, well argued. It's now submitted to the court. We will issue a decision within the statutory timeline. So thank you.